Good evening, everybody. James McCann here with My Science Hour, October 14th, 2021. And starting off tonight, of course, in previous weeks, for many, many weeks, I've been talking about the electric highways to the stars, filling out that topic a little bit over and above my book, The Diamond Principle, and also other aspects of my work. I gave a lecture, which is available on my DVDs that are on the webpage. This is a physical DVD, not a downloadable. But it's a lecture I gave, I believe, and it was 2003, called Electric Highways to the Stars, dealing with electromagnetic propulsion systems. And so anyway, also you're familiar with my work introducing the Colbrin to the Western world, basically. It was 2003. And interestingly enough, that Electric Highways to the Stars video is of a talk I gave at the International UFO Congress, which was held in Laughlin, Nevada. And I was a speaker there 2 years in a row. The other one I talked about was the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colbrin Connection. I introduced that book there. But those videos are available, so you can see me as a, I dare say, a bit younger person, and most people say I look much better today. And at that point, I was fairly heavy. I was balding. My hair has grown back on the top and kind of that ball in the back of my hair. I'm in much better physical condition, etc. And that was because, well, I was working, and finally I learned how to manage my health. Anyway, I'm digressing here. Excuse me. But as a result of that, introducing the Colbrin, and a lot of these topics are completely foreign to any other venue. No matter where you go, you're not going to even hear about these topics, let alone get any detailed information. But out of this came some work, and I introduced, not myself, I introduced to my audience the work of Yvonne Whiteman, who just came out with a couple books that I announced this, I think, on my show last week. It's called The Colbrin. It's called Unlock the Mysteries of the Colbrin. And there's two parts, Sacred and Scandalous Egypt and Genetic and Global Catastrophes, etc. And I'm going to be talking more about many of the related books tonight, Mark Gaffney's book, the Mark Carlotto book, and other types of books, etc. But out of this came an interesting kind of subtopic. And so here's the point. The tentativeness of history. In other words, when you're reading history in a book, and I'm going to use a couple examples here. For example, you may have been taught it in repeatedly throughout your education that man crossed the Bering Strait from, you know, the original man was in Mesopotamia, the birthplace of man, and they grew and they expanded to the northeast, south, and west. And some of those people eventually got to the Bering Strait and then populated the Western Hemisphere, all from this one location in the Mideast. But the problem is that the Western Hemisphere was well populated long before any estimated crossing of the Bering Strait. And, of course, associated with that was the change in sea level by many hundreds of feet. But anyway, this is one of those fun fact stories that literally could not possibly be true. And if you peel away the onion layer, first of all, how did these very different groups of people, we call them races, there's genetic differences, I would call it, because the human race is an overreaching category. But the Orientals, the people in the East, the Far East, are different than those in the Mideast. And then you had groups of, for example, Caucasians, what we call Caucasians, because one of their more recent habitats was the Caucasian, the Caucasus Mountains of Russia, but they came from the Mideast also. And the Israelites, I've talked to that topic before, and how they migrated up into northern Europe, into northern Spain, eventually to the English Islands, and then into Ireland, into the Scandinavian countries. My particular ancestors were from Ireland, obviously, from my name, McCanny. But their ancestors came from the Vikings who moved in from basically Norway and Scandinavia, what is now Scandinavia, into North and Western Ireland in the 800 AD era, you know. And so so those populations were all mixed from Israelites, who are the ones who left with Moses out of Egypt. Anyway, that's the real history. But the fake history that is taught in history books, the point I want to make it, is they teach that as if it is a fact. And, for example, let's look at something in science called the Oort cloud. It's O-O-R-T. It's a cloud, allegedly, of comets that formed around the solar system, you know, way, 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 way far out beyond Pluto, many, many hundreds, thousands of times the distance from the sun to Pluto. And allegedly, this is where comets come from, but it's never been discovered. It's never could be discovered. If you sent out a spacecraft in one direction, it could never ever physically discover the so-called Oort cloud. Yet it is repeated in every text, all the way into graduate school astronomy. PhDs in astronomy repeat this as if it were some kind of fact. And it's not. You know, or the idea that the world, the Earth we live on, started 4.5 billion years ago in a single collapsing event and nothing has happened since. This is standard science and it has no validity. It doesn't explain anything about what we see. Yet it is repeated and repeated by professional scientists, historians, and if we get simply down to the history of man, talk about tentative history. The idea that man originated in the Mesopotamia and all the races of man grew out of this, and somehow the Western Hemisphere was populated by people crossing the Bering Strait so many thousands of years ago, when in fact the populations of the Western Hemisphere are very, very different. Very different. I personally met the Mayan, the Lacandones, who are in southeastern Mexico, in Quintana Roo area, Belize area of southeastern Mexico, very little people. How in 7,000 years did these people somehow evolve over there relative to this 7-foot-tall black man living in Africa? I mean, this doesn't make any sense at all, but it is taught. And so the point is, what's funny is that when, for example, the Colburn came out, immediately it was attacked as being, oh, it's a fake book. Somebody sat in their bedroom and wrote this up and is, you know, it's all fake. And but the reality is, here's how you tell if something is real or not, because I don't care what piece of history you pick up, even recent history, World War II, the Vietnam War, I don't care which piece of history you pick up, it's already been falsified by man and people who have had special interests in creating a different narrative to hide their tracks. So at any rate, the tentativeness of history, especially when it comes to the history of man, what is being taught is extremely tentative, but then these people sit back on their academic laurels and pretend that what they're teaching is somehow sacrosanct and that somehow it is blessed and somehow it has been confirmed by academicians who vote themselves into favor, their little theories, when nothing could be any farther from the truth. And so if you come along with an alternative explanation, as has with the Colburn, then people go, oh, well, that could be just something somebody made up, because there are times at which, and I've pointed out that the Colburn, in fact, are remnants of the library of Joseph of Arimathea. And there's many reasons to understand and believe that is true. We have literally a written record of this happening, where Joseph of Arimathea went to England, what is now Glastonbury. He built his camp there, later became the Abbey. There was a fire where the Romans came out and tried to burn it down, etc. And then the remnants of that were then saved and kept and brought through a series of trusts that eventually produced the Colburn in the early 1990s. And I was one of the first people to get a copy of that. I later got permission to write my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and include that in there, and introducing that to the Western societies. But the point is, then people go, well, that could be just all made up. And here's how you tell if a piece of history is true or not. Does it blend with other adjacent or non-adjacent pieces of information? For example, that the world went through some very tumultuous times at the hands of celestial objects. And so the when the Colburn matches those, then you say these are all verification, because somebody sitting in the 1100s in their bedroom trying to write this down and make up this history, fabricating it, and all of a sudden it matches with other things, like we're learning about pole shifts, physical pole shifts, and the geological evidence of pole shifts. And the Colburn is talking about the same thing. These are meshing stories. These are stories that bring about the exact same information from very different points of view. So to imagine that somebody just sat down and wrote and made this up, it doesn't jive. It doesn't jive. But the point I want to make is that the history that is being pawned off on the public as the history of man is very tentative. The idea that man crossed the Bering Strait to populate the Western Hemisphere, when the Western Hemisphere was fully populated prior to then. We have excavations going on in Antarctica right now, discovering ruins that is all being held from the public, by the way, and also on the planet Mars, indicating that there was human life on Mars, which we have records of. In the ancient texts, there were people living on Mars. It was a water planet, and there was transportation. There was physical transportation between Earth and Mars. Mars had a different orbit. And these are things that come down to us through history books, but it's negated by astronomers who say, well, the Earth is formed 4.5 billion years ago, and all the orbits were stabilized back then, and nothing has happened since, which is just complete nonsense. Because it does not explain anything, even the most rudimentary things. For example, it doesn't explain where the atmosphere and water came from on Earth. And then they go, well, it came in from comets. Well, comets don't have any water on them. They have water in their tail, but not on the surface. The ones we've seen, they don't have any water on the surface at all. Nor do they have atmospheres that are gravitationally held to the nucleus. So, wait a minute. Their story right out of the chute does not hold water. But here's what happens. Because they have taught this and repeated it throughout standard Western knowledge, that great pillar of knowledge, which is completely bogus, because they have done this, they rely on their laurels and can point at something else and say, well, that's ridiculous because it doesn't comply with our, you know, advanced Western knowledge. Here's another topic which just happened to cross my desk this week, and that is the topic of abiotic oil. Now, what's abiotic oil? Abiotic oil is against biological oil. That's what the word means. And biotic oil would be fossil fuels. In other words, dead oil that we see today, and fossil fuels come from plant life. And while you can say that coal comes from plant life, and very definitely, because coal is plant life that has been compacted, the water has been compressed out of it, and you're left with simply carbon, and that's what is burning. However, a lot of the coal has petroleum in it. Some of the coal is dry, it's lower energy content. Some of the coal is very rich with petroleum and is very high burning content, and it doesn't burn as clean because it has all that chemical oil hydrocarbons in it. Well, why does some coal have oil in it and some doesn't? And that's because some coal deposits, like the one that just formed in Madagascar during the when the Indian tsunami occurred, that tsunami came across the ocean, came into Madagascar on the eastern side, swept up all of the material, the vegetation, and piled it up against the side of a mountain, and that someday will be coal. And but there's no oil in it, it's dry coal, because that tsunami occurred from a non-cometary source. If there was a comet involved in the tsunami, then the Earth potentially could be engulfed in the comet tail, and that's where hydrocarbons come from. And then the oil, the coal would be drenched with oil, petroleum, and it would be very high in oil content, telling you that that tsunami that piled up that coal material then was associated with a comet. Associated with a comet, or there might be diamonds in it, and those diamonds were associated also with a comet. So at any rate, the so-called traditional theories of where things come from, in the case of abiotic oil, where they think it happened down deep in the earth, and there was compression, and that's what caused the oil, is really ridiculous. Because how then do you get pools of oil? It doesn't add up. It does not add up at all. And what adds up is that Earth has gone through hundreds and hundreds of episodes where a large comet has come by, Earth has passed through the comet tail, we've had a tremendous influx of hydrocarbons, and the ancients talk about this. The rain of fire and brimstone, they called it burning naphtha, and it burned the skin. Well, what happened? The hydrocarbons came into Earth's atmosphere, congealed, or it liquefied, it turned from the gaseous state into liquid. And then as the meteorites came in that were also associated with the comet, burned up in the atmosphere and actually put the hydrocarbons, started them on fire because they were now in an oxygen-rich atmosphere. And this rained down on the people and burned their skin. It came out of the sky. It rained fire and naphtha. The ancients talk about this. And so anyway, this is what makes sense. This is not tentative history. This is history that makes sense, that comets have had a very important formative stage in the history of man, and very much influential in our development as a civilization, as a culture, as a species on planet Earth, if you want to use that kind of overworked term. But the end result is that abiotic oil doesn't make any sense, yet you have the so-called professors boasting about how it has been proven, and it's unquestionable. Well, it's questionable because, for one thing, if you have this process where you can take dirt and compress it and make oil, well, gee, why aren't they doing that? That would be a very inexpensive way to get oil, much less expensive than putting out a big oil rig on the ocean and drilling down 20 miles. Why not just take the dirt that's already on the surface, compress it, and you got yourself oil in any quantity that you want? But you know why they don't do it? Because you can't. It doesn't work. So abiotic oil doesn't work. It doesn't replace anymore the idea that oil comes from fossil fuels, from rotting dinosaur bones. Then it doesn't make any sense either. So neither one of the big explanations work. But they're touted at the university level as some kind of pillar of knowledge. When, if you peel back the first onion layer, how did the oil come up to the surface? If it was down underground under such high pressure. This is way down in the ground. And the reality is that the first oil deposits that were used commercially around 1200 AD over in the Mideast, in the sand regions of the Mideast, it was sand oil basically, they were in pools. There was just black tar pools. Or how about the tar pools in California, the La Brea tar pits? I've been there. And the story is, when I went through the museum there, I thought, my goodness, this is what they're teaching. They're teaching that the mastodons and the woolly mammoths and the saber-toothed tigers were so stupid that they walked into these pits of tar and kept walking in until they drowned and died. Oh my goodness. I mean, you couldn't make up a more stupid story that an animal would put his foot in and then keep walking in, not just one, but thousands of them. And they walked in there and they were well preserved, of course, in the oil over thousands of years. But to imagine that these animals simply walked into this pool and kept walking in until they were submerged and suffocated, does that make sense to you? Have you ever seen an animal walk in beyond their above their head and suffocate? I mean, come on, boys and girls. This is history that they're teaching in school today. This is being taught. Oh my goodness, no, what happened is that the rain of naphtha, of hydrocarbons came into Earth. And by the way, these same mastodons are pummeled with microdiamonds. And where did the microdiamonds come from? The same comet that brought the hydrocarbons. It all makes sense if you know what's going on. But not in the world of tentative history of man. And so the reason you cannot talk about this is because it doesn't fit the astronomy narrative that the world formed all at one time and nothing has happened since. That's the traditional, that's the Carl Sagan sanctified message from science. And all science, geology, exobiology, genetic lineage of species, extinctions of species, all have to fit this narrative. Mountain building, plate tectonics, all of these things have to fit with this top-down narrative from astronomy that nothing has happened to Earth since it was formed. How about the change of atmosphere? We know that the atmosphere has changed many times. We know that the salt content of the oceans has changed many times. When you get Himalayan salt from up in the mountains in the Himalayas, which came from an ocean, prehistoric ocean, that salt is very different than the salt content of today. As with the salt content in there's a big salt mine and up in the mountains, Rocky Mountains of Colorado, that salt content is very different than the ocean salt content of today. How did that happen? Well, the Earth was a very different place. There was a different sodium content. There was different iodine content. There was difference in all kinds of minerals that are today in the ocean, which were not in the ocean then. And then there are all kinds of minerals in the salt there, the Himalayan salt, that are not in our oceans today. That's why people favor Himalayan salt, is because it has a different repertoire of minerals, which are very good for you, which are not in sea salt, which is good for you, the one of the better salts for you. Excuse me. But anyway, getting back to this idea of the history of man and the standard history which is being taught, which is completely tentative. It has no validity at all. And so when they sit back and criticize somebody like Emmanuel Velikovsky, who hit the nail right on the head that this big comet Venus came through the solar system, it relieved Mars of its oceans and atmosphere, something that NASA still can't get a handle around. They're realizing that Mars had oceans and rivers, but they're going, oh, it was billions of years ago. Based on what? Based on what? Because NASA says so? Because NASA can't have it happen recently because that would agree with Velikovsky? Last week I talked about this giant comet Bernardinelli Bernstein, and it was a planet. It was considered a planet for how many? Almost 8 years. And all of a sudden it starts sprouting a comet tail, and now it's like a comet. And so here you have a planet turning into a comet, and all of a sudden it's an ice ball. And they don't blink an eye. You have a planet heading into the solar system that they forgot to mention to you, by the way, turning into a comet. And all of a sudden, it's just like, yeah, well, that's pretty normal. I mean, these people have no conscience at all. But the concept I want to pass off here once again is that of tentative history. And so when you look at the, especially the history of man, and you look at things, that's why there are people out there scouring archaeological ruins, etc., and finding things that, you know, standard archaeologists just cannot deal with. And that's, I've spent a good part of my life and career, in fact, when I was in a young person living in Mexico, walking around the Mayan ruins and the Aztec ruins, and later in the Incas ruins, etc., you realize that the standard story that's being passed down, that Machu Picchu, for example, was in Inca ruins, well, there was something else going on there a lot earlier than the Incas. And the Incas talk about that. When you talk about, for example, the Nazca Lines, which I discovered and published my paper about well over 5 years ago now, I believe, that showing that the Nazca Lines are, in fact, a fractal antenna system of huge scale, absolutely massive scale, that's only purpose could have been for interstellar communication, certainly interplanetary communication, and that now there have been discovered similar sites around the old equator of Earth and basically making up a deep space network of these transmission antenna systems, all of the same design. The only one that really has the fanciful animals and plants, etc., associated with it is the Nazca lines, but the other ones are very clearly fractal antennas. And so basically the ancients, and these were people that came far before the Incas, or people, I shouldn't even say people. We don't know if they were people or aliens or little beings, and we don't know if they used them or did they simply leave them for us to discover. And fractal antennas have only been in use for maybe 10 years in modern antenna design and engineering design. And you see them most commonly in your cell phone. Fractal antenna is, anyway, my paper on the Nazca line goes into detail on that. But once again, the idea that the Nazca lines, you find all kinds of people, scientists, speculating that they were paths, walking paths or prayer paths, or for maybe agricultural movement of water for agriculture. None of that makes any sense if you're there on the site. If you're there on the site in Nazca, they are undulating plains. They're not flat, and it wouldn't facilitate movement of water at all. Not at all. And the only way you could build these with any accuracy is from far, far above, with a projection on the ground of the shape that you're trying to make. There's no way you could survey these because the ground is undulating. They were not made from a distant mountain because, once again, from any other side vantage point, since the ground is undulating, it would be impossible to do this from the distance, like the mountains off to the eastern range of the Andes Mountains, which lies to the eastern side of the Nazca Plains. It would not be possible. And so anyway, all of the standard stories that try and avert the concept that the whoever built the Nazca lines had the ability of flight. And not only flight, but stationary flight. Another, maybe a balloon, maybe something as simple as a hot air balloon. But they had to have a vertical a view of the areas and a ability to project the shape downwards onto this the plains of Nazca. So at any rate, once again, standard history cannot explain where any of this came from, but if you understand that the history of man goes way back, advanced civilizations have occurred many times, then all of a sudden, the fairy tale history books that are being taught have no validity. And so then we get back to the question of the tentativeness of history. Where is that golden standard where you have one epoch of history leading to the next and leading to the next and well documented with all of the I's dotted and the T's crossed that gives you what you call standard history of man? There isn't any. It's all tentative. So to for the kettle to call the pot black, or the pot to call the kettle black, as the expression says, you know, they're both on the fire. They're both black because they're sooted because of being on the fire. And that's an old expression, that don't throw stones at your neighbor, let alone, you know, the person that is without sin cast the first stone. And that can't happen in history because everybody's history is tentative. So very important. Okay, I'm going to interject a little thing here that came in from a listener. And this was very interesting. There was a book by Isaac Asimov, a classic book, regarding the space travel. And, of course, Isaac Asimov wrote back in the, I don't know when this was, back in the 50s maybe. I'll pull this up here in a minute. But anyway, it's very interesting because the reader, the listener, compares my version of what traveling in space should be like, because I wrote the book, The Diamond Principle, which is available, of course, on my webpage. By the way, please don't buy my books on Amazon. I don't sell my books on Amazon. And if anybody is selling them there, they're not, they're potentially knockoffs or maybe old versions of the book or something like that. So anyway, if you want my materials, get them on my webpage. And also, I just want to advertise a little bit here, my education package. It's on my webpage, jmccsci.com. It's the fourth item there, and it's my education package, which is the culmination of 4 years of putting together lectures. It deals with my books. It deals with all the various topics that I talk about, Tesla, space, energy, water, and a very long list of other topics. In this education program is for adults, it's for high school, it's for grade school, and it really, it's something that's totally lacking in classes today regarding the education of science. I'm starting to get more and more involved with education programs, because it's very important, but I could try and insert mathematical courses or other courses, but I don't. The thing I concentrate in is the lack of science, real science, which delves into the history of man, into astronomy, astrophysics, space science, etc., for students, and from a Christian conservative perspective, because that's the closest thing we have to the truth. But then as the atheist communists moved in, and Carl Sagan was one of the biggest proponents of atheist Marxist communism, you know, teaching that the kids are just monkeys, a little bit smarter monkey than the one out in the jungle, and so therefore you're all the same. And your creativity comes from some kind of evolutionary feat of man over monkeys, and that you're just advanced because of a couple thousand years of evolution, but you're just a monkey like the monkey out in the jungle. That's what Carl Sagan taught. Most people don't know it. They think he's some kind of great scientist. No. He was promoting an agenda to destroy science in education for students, and that's what it was all about. And don't question Carl. He's supposedly the smartest man on the planet. That's how they build him. And, of course, he bought it hook, line, and sinker. He was the most arrogant guy you could imagine. He thought he was just, you know, this head back, and Carl is so smart on Johnny Carson's show representing the scientific community. No, the guy was a complete idiot. But he was also a very useful idiot in that he promoted the communist atheist agenda to destroy science in school. What he taught was astronomers smart, kids dumb, listen to the astronomers, they tell you facts, you listen to the, repeat the facts, you get an A, and now you're smart in science. That's what Carl Sagan taught. And I don't do that at all. I teach people about science, about the true nature of comets, etc. And so anyway, very important. But I want to read this just quickly as the listener passes his thoughts along in this blog note. But anyway, here it is. And once again, this is about Isaac Asimov's book. And let me see, what is the name of the book? Let me just, I'm going to get the name of Isaac Asimov's book here. Okay, click that out of the way. It's called Foundation. This is one of the Isaac Asimov. Okay, so here it is, the comment by listener. It says, excellent book and an excellent series that has probably inspired millions of people to imagine life in the future or past in far remote solar systems and really advanced spacefaring society, just as vulnerable to human problems as anything humans have ever known through our ages of development, except maybe for a few things. Asimov takes and imagines the universe as being based on a linear development in an electrically neutral universe without any incident of cometary or catastrophic action. It would have been very interesting if he instead, talking of Asimov, it would have been very fascinating if he, instead of writing against his temporary, Emanuel Velikovsky, perhaps the original psycho-historian, had embraced his thoughts on worldwide upheavals and subsequent collective amnesia, a term first coined by Velikovsky. And so I'm going to stop here for just a minute. In other words, what this fan is saying in his commentary about Asimov's book called Foundation is that he used the standard traditional concept of astronomy as a basis for the, you know, the what you would encounter in outer space. And this was contemporary with Emanuel Velikovsky, the same time frame as Velikovsky was popularizing his version of the catastrophic history of mankind, and of course mentioning collective amnesia, that was a term coined by Velikovsky, who was a psychologist. So I'm going to continue reading here. Perhaps the closest thing to imagining human space ventures would be a book by Professor James McCanney called The Diamond Principle, where he does take these and many factors into account as he sets about designing a space program that would bring mankind into space, not just a handful of at a time in a close Earth orbit, but millions settled into large autonomous space stations dotted in and around our solar system, discussing the vectors, metrics, and effort required to ensure such... Oops, just a second, I lost my page here. Give me a second, please. Okay, I clicked on the wrong thing. That happens with live radio. Whoosh. Okay, anyway, I'll read this again. Perhaps the closest thing to imagining human space ventures would be a book by Professor James McCanney called The Diamond Principle, where he does take these and many factors into account as he sets about designing a space program that would bring mankind into space, not just a handful of at a time in close Earth orbit, but millions settled into large autonomous space stations dotted in and around our solar system, discussing the vectors, metrics, and effort required to ensure such a humongous undertaking a success. Only available from his website, jmccsci.com, and if you are in a pinch, let me suggest you listen to the free archived radio shows from summer and autumn of 2021, where he, and at this point, the article just kind of cuts off for some unknown reason. So the author, the person that wrote this, doesn't know why that disappeared either. Maybe he said something that somebody didn't like. Anyway, this book review can be found on Goodreads, and it's the Isaac Asimov Foundation book, and this is a commentary clearly by one of my fans. But yeah, clearly The Diamond Principle is a book that, I mean, you have to read this probably about three times to really get the full impact of where the human race is. This was written as an analysis, and I thought it was rather interesting when I released this book. It was on Coast to Coast AM. The host was George Norrie. And the programming put on a co-host, or not a co-host, a co-guest along with me, which I didn't know about, who was a rah-rah NASA, everything is fine, the rockets going into space are just great. And within a week of my book coming out, was one of the so-called co-written books by Stephen Hawking's. This is the extent that they went to. Now, remember that Stephen Hawking's was completely immobilized, if not already dead. And they had a person who claimed he could still communicate with Stephen Hawking's, who was writing these books, which was, of course, ridiculous. And so what they did is they took Stephen Hawking's actual message, which was very good, that there was a grand design. In fact, the last real book that Hawking wrote, the very last page, the very last paragraph in the book, stated that the universe, if we can just discover some of the physics of how this grand universe works, we will have come closer to understanding the greatest mind in the universe, which is the creator. And so, and then they try and twist Einstein into being an atheist. Einstein was not an atheist. He just did not have a secular religion that he went to church every Sunday to. There's a difference. There's a big, big difference. In fact, Einstein said the same thing. He said, the more I understand about science, the more I believe in a divine creator, which is what my position is, always has been. And what you find is that man-made religions, or man-sponsored religions, let's just put it that way, have a lot of, let's just put it this way, rigmarole associated with them. And that leads me to my next topic. Now, a week ago, not yesterday, but a week ago yesterday on the John Moore Show, I was on the radio show, and I got into this topic about the Heaven's Gate not being a mass suicide but a mass murder, and that they had about 30,000 people coming in who were followers, and this is when Hale Bopp came in and was exploded into brightness, and Hale Bopp had a companion, and there was signaling going on. Maybe it was just electrical signaling from the comet, but it was interpreted by the insiders in the astronomy, space science, astrophysics, and intelligence world, the CIA and their minions, which was by now well in, NASA was very well controlled by the CIA at this point. That started in 1991 with the demise of Robert Harrington, the denial of Planet X, which became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, etc. So anyway, they didn't expect this thing to turn into a comet. And so all of a sudden it becomes a comet. Hale and Bopp discover it as amateurs. And the Courtney Brown and Chuck Schrammick send their pictures to Art Bell, which starts this whole fiasco and the Heaven's Gate incident. But anyway, what the Heaven's Gate people were doing was they were going to go out in the Hollywood Hills, which is an outdoor amphitheater, basically, and have 30,000 people putting their psychic capabilities together to communicate with aliens. Now, you may say, well, this is nuts or whatever. I'll tell you from my inside context, the CIA was freaking out over this because they know that public camaraderie, when you get a number of people together outside, now this is the key, that they have tremendous psychological and psychic powers. And to have 30,000 of them, not just the 37 Heaven's Gate people who happen to live in the same place in L.A. who are programmers, very good programmers, world-class programmers. And by the way, the terms Heaven Gate meant it had to do with their programming. And what they were doing was building firewalls and encryption techniques that the CIA could not break into. So that was another no-no that they were involved in. But that's where the term Heaven's Gate came from. And after they were murdered, they supposedly all came together and ate this porridge. Well, that's ridiculous because they were on their way out to the Hollywood Hills to sit there and camp out until the aliens came. And they got basically snuffed out. literally, just like that happened to James Jones down in South America. Same thing, the CIA came in, and in fact, we actually have a name for the poison, the formula that they gave these people. We call it the CIA porridge. But at any rate, be that as it may, those are some issues. But anyway, back to John Moore's show. I'm talking about this on the air, and I get to the point where I'm saying that if you get a small group of people or a large group of people, whatever, and you start putting your psychological powers together, and this is like a universal kind of context, tapping into the universal stream of consciousness, in a sense, because of the group of people. And I said, you have to do this outside. And when I said that, John got two phone calls, bang, bang, immediately. And one woman gets on. John says, well, we got 3 minutes to go. Let's take one more caller. So this woman gets on, and the first thing she says is, I don't know what you have to be outside for. You can be in a church as long as you're all together. And so the first thing she did was deny what I was saying. And then she went on, and she said, she started rambling on and on about things. And then she was talking about their college roommates were smoking, and she didn't like it, but then again, she was okay with it. And going, just rambling about nothing. And I finally cut her off, and I said, lady, you're trying to cover my last 3 minutes here, so I can't continue talking. So I figured, wow, did I push the hot button that time? So anyway, because in honor of the fact that they don't want me to talk about this, I will spend the rest of my show now talking about it. In fact, you might want to listen to John's show yesterday also, where this topic, let's just put it this way, I brought it up again on purpose. But let me talk about this in light of my discoveries about the electric nature of the solar system, the electric vertical electric field of planet Earth, and the communication. And so let me tell you something as a scientist. In fact, people have come to me out of the intelligence community, and these are military scientists. These are physicists. These are people that have spent 35 years as physicists in the intelligence community. So they know, you know, everything about nuclear submarines or the nuclear program. And they've come out to me and they said, how do you figure out everything that you figure out? What are you doing? In fact, when the last time I was on with George Norrie, he asked me the same thing. He said, are you dreaming when you come up with this stuff? And he actually asked me on the air, he said, how many projects are you working on right now, Jim? And I said, looking at my desk, I'd say about 25 projects. You know, some are public, most of them are not. And, you know, so, I mean, it's clear, you know, and one thing I figured out is, number one, you have to have a very pure conscience. You have to have a very pure mental state to really understand how things work. And so there are a lot of good scientists out there, lots of good physicists. They're well-trained. They can invent things. They can get patents. They can push the edge of knowledge, etc., but they'll never be great physicists. They're not the ones that push the envelope into places where nobody has been before, literally, like what I've done. And I know what I've done. I'm not bragging. It's just I'm familiar with the history of physics, one of my primary topics that I understand very well, and that's why I know where to investigate, where to put my mental capabilities. But I understand what it takes to make new discoveries. I know where to look. I have the background. I have all of my theoretical work. For example, when I finally got to Cornell as a young person and I'm hired into the faculty, when I started seeing all the data coming in from space probes, I already had all my theoretical work done, basically the electrical conditions and how electrical discharges worked in outer space and plasma conditions. I had all that done because I'd been working on it as a theoretical problem. So when I started seeing the data roll in, it just all came together at the same time. But at any rate, now let's talk about the human psyche. And I'll just add a little piece here. When I was working with Russian scientists back in the mid-1990s, this was the staff in the atmospheric physics department at the University of Novosibirsk in Russia, Central Russia, and the space scientists there and some astronomers, and they were in a group and they were translating my work, and there's discussion going on every day as they were piecing together the work that I had done. And then these were experimentalists, so they were experimenting. They knew there was atmospheric electricity. They knew there were tornadoes on the sun. They had no idea how any of this worked, and I came along and my theoretical work explained it all. So that's why they were very interested in my work. But interestingly enough, the psychology department at the University of Novosibirsk was studying the psychological effects on unborn infants before birth and then after birth, and they were doing readings, electromagnetic readings and brainwave readings, etc., from the babies, first before they were born and then after they were born, and they realized that there was something that happened psychologically at the point of birth. And they related it to the planets and the positions of the planets. And so when I came along and they realized that the planets are all communicating electronically, and they said, wow, this explains why in astrology, which is a science, this is what astronomy grew out of, the measurement of the position of the stars. And a lot of people think, oh, astrology, that's that hokey stuff you read in, you know, the newspaper every day. They give your horoscope or your astroloscope or whatever. But these guys were putting a scientific basis to it, understanding, first of all, from unborn infants and then after they were born in that time of birth. It was very important because then the baby disconnected from the mother. And all that time in the mother, their main method of communication was electrical, and tying into that electrical communication that is in the universe, kind of the cosmic universal connection. But when they were born, all of the other senses kicked in and flooded the neurosystem of the baby with all this other data, and then a lot of them lost this. Well, I managed to regain this because I understood that it was going on, etc. So anyway, now let's get back to groups of people getting together, putting their psychological prowess together. And how do they do this? And this is one of the things I said on the air, is that churches have a roof. The thing that is common with all churches, with all mosques, with all temples, or whatever you want to call it, is they have some kind of a roof over them, which basically cuts off your communication in the dielectric atmosphere that is between us and the electric fields up in the upper atmosphere. And so literally, when I walk from a building to outside, I can feel the change. I can feel it on my head. I can feel it, because I know what to look for, and you probably could feel it too if you knew what to look for. But in the morning, sometimes I'll wake up, I'll walk outside, and I need that connection to the atmosphere and to the electrical fields that are in the atmosphere. So when you are getting together, and this is what they don't want you to know, so I'm teaching you on this show. So when you get together with a group of people to pray, to communicate, to meditate, etc., go outside. You need to be outside for it to work and to function properly. And you'll find a lot of people, a lot of the Mideastern sects, a lot of the Buddhists, etc., when they do their exercise, when they do their meditation, when they do their whatever they call it, their movements, their concentration, they go outside. And that's very important. And this is something that's been intentionally taken away from Western society. And with the vaccinations, and what they're doing is they're clouding that region of the brain with the vaccinations, with the graphene oxide, magnetic graphene oxide, etc. They're clouding that region of the brain, which they say has connection to religious. And the people who are atheists, communists, trying to take control of the world, who are trying to force the vaccination on everybody, the biggest thing they want you to do is, stay in your house. Don't go out of your house. They don't want anybody recognizing, until they get this shot in everybody, which dulls your brain, the electrical connection of your brain, and they want to desperately keep people shut down. So, in honor of that, what I'm teaching you on this show is how to communicate, and you should do this with people especially who have not been vaccinated. If you have somebody vaccinated, what they're going to do that's going to be like an albatross around your ankle, a lead ball around your ankle, because they're not going to be able to connect in very well, if at all, with the electrical signaling that's going on. And part and parcel to this is the vertical electric field. And I'm also now convinced that that's what the 5G is all about, and that the microwaves, etc., is to flood the airwaves so that the personal communication with the higher entities or with the universal consciousness does not happen anymore. That's why that's how they control things. That's how one of the methods of control. So go out far away from any cities, away from any 5G, out in the country, and up on a hilltop someplace. And you'll find that some of the great prophets did this also. For example, Christ, when he had his lectures with people, thousands of people coming to hear him lecture, it was outside. There was no church. There was no building. He did not do it in the temple. He despised the temple. It was not a place of worship. And too many times the temple becomes something where you come and you repeat prayers, but you don't really connect. It's not connecting you with the spiritual side of your being. Okay, so anyway, as I say, this is exactly what they don't want me to be saying, and it's very clearly came out on John Moore's show. When I started talking about this, bing, bing, two people, that just shows you how scared they are of people finding this out. They came in to shut me down, talk over me, and prevent you, the public, from understanding this. Okay, well, I've got about a minute left here. I still did not get into my topics of the Colburn, of the other books related to the history of the catastrophic events and things like that. But this show is going to be here next week, and I'll be talking about those topics. But it all ties in together to the true history of man, of mankind, etc. Just want to remind you, my webpage, I have the two webpages, the jmccsci.com. On that page, go get the education package. There's a lot more material like this there, and it's based on Christian, conservative, scientific education that's a supplement. And then also my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, where if you use the coupon code JMCC, you get a 10% discount at checkout on anything you purchase on that page. I've got the replacement water filter elements for gravity. I've got a beautiful stainless steel sink filter, and then the MR5 whole house water filter. And I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.